This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 45 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Handcuff Twitter was lit this past weekend. Jonathan Williams was cut by the Bills, and I sent a somewhat snarky tweet that read, "A reminder to stop drafting running back handcuffs in fantasy football." And then people got very mad at me online. I've written an article and done a podcast on this topic, so most of you listening probably know my thoughts on handcuffing in fantasy football. Rehashing those details on here, on this episode, wouldn't make any sense. You should go listen to episode 20 if you're interested in hearing some data surrounding why handcuffing is a bad strategy. My tweet wasn't to say that Jonathan Williams didn't have some flex appeal in deeper leagues. That's especially true in best ball leagues, where you knew he'd probably have a couple of usable weeks throughout the season, all while having the upside of being the top back with a LeSean McCoy injury. That was probably the best place to take him in those best ball leagues. But my tweet saying a reminder to stop drafting running back handcuffs in fantasy football is about the notion that we know far less about things than we think that we know. Because that's one of the key elements as to why handcuffing doesn't work when you're drafting handcuffs. Not only do injuries not always occur, and not only do those injuries occur later in the season, and not only do running backs who do step in typically not perform, but we actually get the handcuff wrong all of the time when we're drafting them. We think we know more than we actually do. Handcuff later in the season, that's totally fine. But to assume you know what things will look like when the hypothetical time comes for a backup to step up for an injured elite starter is sort of arrogant. And that's not how I play fantasy football. The way I do play fantasy football is going to be outlined on this podcast each week throughout the season. As I've mentioned before, my 15 transactions column on NumberFire is my brain dump. It's where my brain goes number two. I talk about players you should be adding and dropping, but more importantly, I talk about guys that you should be buying and selling in fantasy football. I'm super excited because this is officially the first 15 transaction episode of the season. This is one of 17. We're officially here. Before we look into the transactions as we enter week one, though, I wanted to send a quick note that with the NFL season here, remember that you can catch all the games on TuneIn and the TuneIn app. At home or on the go, listen to the home call of every game live, or pop in and out of the action every Sunday with NFL First and Goal. That's TuneIn's audio red zone station. Download the TuneIn app today and listen to the NFL for free for 30 days. TuneIn is your everything audio app. Now let's look into these transactions. Sell Jordan Howard. Howard finished 2016 with a 66.32% rushing attempt market share in that Bears backfield, which actually ended up being the third highest total in the NFL. And that's insane when you realize that he accumulated most of those touches in just 13 games. There's nothing wrong getting a running back who's going to see a lot of volume. But part of this game of fantasy football is about scoring. And only the Rams, Browns, and Jets scored fewer points than the Bears did last year, and just six teams ranked worse in touchdown rate per drive. Heading into this season, the Bears are projected to be the fifth worst team in football according to NumberFire metrics, and Vegas has them pegged with an over-under of just 5.5 wins. And they've got Mike Glennon, a career backup, starting for them at quarterback, and their top wide receiver, easily their top wide receiver, Cam Meredith, is now sidelined for the year with an ACL injury. So that's not a lot of wins within a bad offense. That means a lot of negative game scripts and not a lot of opportunity. And that's the other thing with this. If games do get out of hand for the Bears, are we sure that Jordan Howard is going to be on the field? Because there's a lot of hype surrounding Tariq Cohen right now, a smaller back. He weighs 179 pounds, kind of profiles like a Darren Sproles type. He's electric, and he could be used as a pass catcher. If they start to utilize Tariq Cohen, which would make sense, because Howard caught just 29 of 50 targets last year, ending his rookie season with a 14% drop rate, which was the worst in football at the running back position. If they utilize Tariq Cohen as a third down running back or a guy that they throw on the field in those negative game scripts, then not only does Jordan Howard not have the touchdown upside within this bad offense that's not going to win a lot of games, but he's also not going to see a lot of catches with Tariq Cohen there. There are so many red flags surrounding Jordan Howard as we enter this season, and as much as I think that he's a pretty good talent, I'm not buying into him at all in 2017. Add Carson Palmer. I've mentioned Palmer a ton on this show, and if you're a quarterback streamer, the main reason you want to get Carson Palmer is his early season schedule. The first 4 weeks, in week one, he gets the Lions, who look awful on defense, and the game over-under is already set at 48 points. Then the next week, he gets the Colts, a defense that might be even worse, and they might not even have Vontae Davis, their top corner. And then they'll close out the first quarter of the season with the Cowboys and 49ers, two very beatable secondaries. Let's not forget that Carson Palmer was an MVP candidate in 2015. Air yards were a big difference between his 2016 and 2015 season. Not that he didn't throw for a lot of air yards last year. He did. He had the fourth most air yards in all of football. But he only had six touchdowns on throws that went 15 plus yards through the air. In 2015, that number was 13. Given his air yards total last season, we should have expected him to throw 3.80 more deep ball touchdowns than he actually had. He's in an offense that loves to throw the ball vertically. We know that Bruce Arians loves that type of offense. And in that offense, with a little bit of positive regression, Carson Palmer, aside from those first 4 weeks, might actually be pretty fantasy relevant all season long. By Ted Ginn. Even before this Willie Snead suspension that came out of nowhere, Ted Ginn Jr. was a perfect buy. There's literally no better place for Ted Ginn than with Drew Brees and the Saints. Over the last two seasons in Carolina, Ted Ginn averaged 11.11 air yards per catch. Among 92 wideouts with 50 or more targets in 2016, that rate, which is his average over a two-year span, would have ranked 18th highest in football. Look, this is not something shocking. Ted Ginn is a deep ball specialist who's honed in on his overall skill set at wide receiver as his career has matured. But then you look at him with Drew Brees. Brees was 8th in the NFL in pass attempts that traveled 15 or more yards through the air a season ago, and he finished with the most passing yards in all of football on those types of throws. And this is not anything new either. He ranked 3rd in yards on passes that went 15 plus air yards in 2015, he was 2nd in 2014, 1st in 2013, 4th in 2012, and 2nd in 2011. It's almost like Drew Brees is pretty good at throwing footballs. Without Brandon Cooks in the mix, and with Snead's suspension to start the year, there's a ton of opportunity in New Orleans. As I noted on a previous mailbag episode, Ginn has played number 2 wide receiver snaps for the Saints in the preseason, and while that's not the biggest deal in the world for the Saints because they rotate personnel, I mean, Brandon Cooks last year led the team in wideout snaps, and he still ranked 33rd in the NFL at the position in percentage of snaps played. But it's still a little something extra. We know that he's going to be on the field a lot, and that's a good thing. And the Saints have averaged, this is an average, 664 pass attempts per season over the last 6 years. In order for Ginn to just reach triple-digit targets, assuming that they'll be around that same mark this year, he just needs about a 15% target market share in that offense. I think it's entirely possible that Ted Ginn hits that target market share mark, and in an offense with Drew Brees, getting a guy with triple-digit targets is unbelievable. And he shouldn't be that difficult to acquire right now. Add Kobe Fleener. So I mentioned the Willie Snead suspension, and while I do think that it does help Ted Ginn a bit, I think the one player in that offense that it might help most is Kobe Fleener. Snead will be the Saints slot receiver this year. Last season, he ran 77.05% of his routes from the slot, which was the 11th highest rate in the league among 50-plus target wideouts. The New Orleans skill position player who lines up in that area of the field is Kobe Fleener. While they're going to have to play someone in the slot at wide receiver, maybe it's Austin Carr who they just acquired, maybe it's someone else, no one on that roster has that much NFL, legitimate NFL experience in the slot. And it's a small sample, but Snead did miss a game last year when the Saints faced the Falcons in Week 3. In that game, Kobe Fleener played 77% of New Orleans snaps, which was his second highest rate of the season, and he caught 7 of 11 targets for 109 yards and a touchdown. Those 11 targets were over a 20% market share in the offense. It was his second best fantasy performance of the entire season and the third best fantasy performance of his entire career. You might say that's just a coincidence, the sample size is small, but I think there's enough logic this year. It's a slot receiver's production being replaced by a pass-catching tight end. And I think that warrants a look off the waiver wire, at least as a tight end streamer over the first 3 weeks of the season. Sell Jarvis Landry. Look, I'm not here to speculate what could happen with Jarvis Landry and this alleged domestic violence incident. That's a horrible situation. It's not my job to talk about something like that. I'm analyzing fantasy football. But I do know that it certainly is not a good thing for Jarvis Landry. And that's on top of some on-the-field issues. Landry finished 2016 with 94 receptions, but after Jay Ajayi's breakout in Week 6, Landry's catches per game dropped from 6.80 to 5.45. He caught 4 fewer passes in 5 of his 11 games, as the Dolphins became the third most run-heavy team in football over this time. The only teams that ran the ball more than the Dolphins after Jay Ajayi's breakout were Dallas and Buffalo. And the Dolphins ran the fewest plays in all of football last season. And that's a big deal for a guy who's been volume dependent across his career. And then there's the Devontae Parker factor. Quarterback Jay Cutler seems to really have a connection going with Parker, which could result in a higher target market share for Parker in 2017. Last season, Parker's target market share sat at 18.45%, which allowed Landry to see over 27% of Miami's targets. We know that Jay Cutler plays into Devontae Parker's skill set more than what Ryan Tannehill would. When Cutler was quarterbacking the Bears under Adam Gase, this was back in 2015 before Gase was hired by the Dolphins in 2016, he threw the ball 15 or more yards down the field on 18.84% of his passes. Under Gase last season, Ryan Tannehill's rate was 15.94%. Landry, who's a low average depth of target player, will naturally benefit from a quarterback who's throwing it closer to the line of scrimmage than down the field. Jay Cutler might not be the right fit for Jarvis Landry. So if there's a buyer out there, I would definitely field some offers for Jarvis Landry. Add Chris Carson. I've mentioned this before, but Chris Carson certainly did not pop up from a production standpoint in college. He averaged just 9.11 carries per game during his final season at Oklahoma State, and he tallied a 16.70% rushing attempt market share. That type of college workload is rarely seen from effective NFL running backs. But I don't care. He's looked great in the preseason, and that Seahawks backfield depth chart is certainly questionable. Ahead of Carson on that depth chart is Eddie Lacy, Thomas Rawls, and CJ Procise. The latter two have been nursing injuries, and the former is Eddie Lacy. He's had weight goals to hit throughout the summer. And not only that, but Lacy hasn't shown much since he joined the Seahawks. Rawls put together one of the most ineffective seasons last year that our database at NumberFire has ever seen, and Procise has yet to carry the ball more than 30 times in the NFL. There's plenty of question marks in this backfield. And if one does emerge, he could be great from a fantasy standpoint. When a Seahawks running back saw 60% or more of the team's snaps in a game last year, there were 9 instances of this. On average, that running back ranked as RB19 in that given week. 4 of the 9 games resulted in top 12 RB1 performances, with another 2 ranking in the top 24. Those are basically RB1 numbers. I'm not saying that Chris Carson is going to be the workhorse back in this offense. I don't think probability tells us that's going to happen. But he's absolutely worth a bench stash given the question marks surrounding this Seattle Seahawks backfield. Sell Sammy Watkins. I know that people are buying into the Rams offense this year, and I do see some upside, or at least for them to be a lot better than what they were last season. But we can't lose sight of the negatives. Jared Goff is still under center, and he was really bad last year. Over the last 10 years, among quarterbacks who threw the ball 100 or more times during their first season in the league, Goff's adjusted net yards per attempt ranks 4th worst. And if you change that filter to 200 or more passes, he's the absolute worst. His poor play resulted in an air yards per attempt rate that was lowest in the entire NFL last year among relevant quarterbacks. Meanwhile, Sammy Watkins is known to stretch the field with his big plays. Over the last 2 years, there have been 179 wide receiver instances where a wideout had 50 or more targets during a season. Watkins 2015 and 2016 ranked 4th and 5th, respectively, in air yards per catch. So you got Sammy Watkins who can get down the field with a guy who has not shown at the NFL level that he can get the ball down the field. That creates a very scary floor. Sammy Watkins does have some upside in week 1 because Vontae Davis is not going to play. But I don't see his season-long upside. I really don't. The Rams aren't going to score that much. They're going to be a run-first team. That's all going to hurt Sammy Watkins. You can risk this transaction for after week 1, but if you can trade him now, I would totally do it, even though his week 1 matchup looks pretty juicy. Add Buck Allen. One of the best ways to find unknown running back value in fantasy football is simply by targeting backfields with ugly starters. Terrence West is an ugly starter. Last season, according to NumberFire's net expected points metric, West had a minus 0.04 rushing NEP per rush average with a 36.79% success rate. Just to give you guys some context, the average rushing NEP per rush among running backs last season was minus 0.02, so he was worse than average, and the average success rate usually hovers around the 40% mark, so he was below average there too. And what's really interesting is that among all running backs last season, if you were to compare starting running backs to how their teammates performed, the best running back within that context was actually Kenneth Dixon. Kenneth Dixon crushed in our expected points model at NumberFire. In other words, either Kenneth Dixon was really good, or Terrence West was just really not good. And I think that the latter has a good chance to be true. because Terrence West has bounced around teams during his career and he has a career 3.9 yards per carry average. So if that's the case, then you should keep your eye on the man who would take over West's role in that backfield, at least on early downs, and that's Buck Allen. And the other thing too, we do have a sample size, or at least somewhat of a sample size, of Buck Allen. If you recall in 2015, Allen toted the rock 138 times, and he saw 62 targets out of the backfield within the Ravens offense. It was a terrible offense. Joe Flacco was injured, but he was better than Terrence West in that same situation. I just don't think we should automatically assume that Terrence West is going to carry the load throughout this entire season. And I do think that Buck Allen is actually a better running back than Terrence West is. So I think he's a great speculative ad. Buy Eric Ebron. I've talked up Ebron all offseason. Let's just get right to it. Anquan Boldin is out of the Lions offense. That frees up 23 red zone targets, which was the second most targets in the entire NFL at wide receiver. Boldin also ranked third in targets from within his opponent's 10-yard line, so those are also up for grabs. Boldin played in the slot last year. He was Detroit's slot receiver. Only six wide receivers with 50 or more targets ran a higher percentage of their routes from the slot than Anquan Boldin did last year. That's the area of the field that Eric Ebron will be. Ebron's missed time over the last 2 years, but when you prorate his market share to a 16-game season, then you're looking at, last season, a 17.61% target market share. That's insane. That's really, really good for a tight end. If they give him more love in the red zone, I know that's an if because he's never been a touchdown scorer, but if he can hit 6, 7, 8 touchdowns, Eric Ebron could easily be a top 6 tight end this season. I would be buying him. Sell or drop Jamaal Charles. I say sell or drop because in some leagues you can probably flat out drop him, but I would still shop Jamaal Charles to see if anyone is really high on him. Because some people are. When Charles was finally cleared to practice with the Broncos in July, the team was very open. They said that they wanted to get him the ball 8 to 10 times per game if he could stay healthy. And that's exactly why I'm struggling to find any sort of upside into holding Jamaal Charles in fantasy football. I get it. He's one of the greatest running backs we've ever seen. I love Jamaal Charles, but he's also 30 years old, who's played a combined 8 games since the start of the 2014 season. And he's playing in a Denver offense that, number one, is probably not going to be very good, and number two, they have a lot of running backs. They might not be great running backs, but they have a lot of them. I think if there's one running back in this backfield that you want to throw a dart at, it's D'Angelo Henderson. But Jamaal Charles has capped usage in a subpar offense. What is the reason to keep him on your fantasy roster? Add Sam Bradford. The number one reason you want to add Sam Bradford before week one starts is because he's playing the Saints. Over the last 3 seasons, when you remove week 17, quarterbacks against the Saints have averaged 20.33 standard fantasy points per game. They've basically been 2016's Andrew Luck. And only 3 of those quarterbacks, 6.67% of them, posted fewer than 12 fantasy points. But I also think that Sam Bradford kind of has intriguing season-long value in deeper leagues as well. Last year, he had the 6th lowest air yards per attempt rate. That's not good. But among passers with 200 or more attempts last season, only Matt Ryan, Andrew Luck, Drew Brees, Tom Brady, and Dak Prescott had a higher completion percentage on passes that traveled 15 or more yards through the air. I think a lot of that has to do with Minnesota's offensive line. If that offensive line comes together, they move Stephon Diggs to the outside, who can stretch the field a bit. I think Sam Bradford, again, has very interesting upside. So if you're in a deep league that hoards quarterbacks, he's still not a bad addition if you're not just adding him for this week one matchup. Sell Frank Gore. Look, guys, I know. Arguably no analyst in fantasy football was higher than Frank Gore in July. I podcasted about it. I wrote about it. I screamed from the mountaintops about it. I loved Frank Gore. But all of the allure with Frank Gore is gone. Andrew Luck's health is a big, big question mark in this offense, and center Ryan Kelly could miss half the season with an injury of his own. The reason you were drafting Frank Gore before was because of his high floor. You were getting RB2, high-end RB2, production in the middle rounds of your drafts. Now, that floor is gone. Frank Gore does not have a floor, and in turn, Frank Gore is not a valuable piece in fantasy football, and I'm sad about it. Add Austin Hooper. Hooper is still available in over 60% of ESPN fantasy leagues. As a rookie, among the 56 tight ends with 20 or more targets, his air yards per catch rate was 5th best in football. And his 4.42 yards after the catch per reception was certainly above average for that type of air yards rate. The thing is with most tight ends, and this is no different for Austin Hooper, touchdown potential is key. And I think that could be there for Austin Hooper this year. Devontae Freeman last year saw 18 targets in the red zone, and Tevin Coleman saw 11. Only 14 players, not just running backs, players, saw more volume in the red zone through the air than Devontae Freeman did last year. We should expect some regression in the red zone from those running backs, and that could really, really help Austin Hooper. And I think that's even more so when you figure that Julio Jones has never been a red zone weapon in that offense with Matt Ryan. He actually only had 10 red zone targets last season. He's averaged 9.84 targets per game over his career, but Julio has averaged fewer than 7 touchdowns per season over his last 3 years. So if you have a deep bench, I think a perfect tight end stash, or even a play in week one, is Austin Hooper. Add the Buffalo Bills defense. At a high level, to figure out if a defense is worthy of a stream, you should ask 3 questions. Is the team a strong favorite? Are they at home? And does the opponent have a bad quarterback who turns the ball over? With the Bills in week one, the answer to all of those questions is yes. They're now 8-point favorites against the Jets, so they're going to probably see a positive game script. They're at home, and the Jets are starting Josh McCown, who started 3 games last year and threw 5 interceptions. I do want to say that I wish that Tyrod Taylor was a lock to play this game just for positive game script purposes. But the Bills are in a very, very good spot. They're a very safe play this week. Add the Rams defense. The Rams seem optimistic that Aaron Donald is going to suit up in week one, and that'll be very, very big against the Colts offensive line, who, again, is without Ryan Kelly. Andrew Luck's not going to play. That means that LA is going to be going up against Scott Tolzien, who has 3 career NFL starts. In his only start last year against Pittsburgh, he threw 2 picks and he was sacked 3 times. There's absolutely no reason to believe that he's going to light up the Rams, so I think that the Rams as well are a very strong streaming option. That'll do it for the first 15 transaction episode though, guys. Thanks for tuning in. As usual, you can subscribe to the show by going to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Play, and TuneIn so that you don't miss another show. And if you haven't yet, remember to go to iTunes and leave a rating and review. On Thursday, I'll be picking 2 random people who have to give a free NumberFire subscription for a year. So go do that. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back in your ears on Thursday with the Week 1 Start Sit Show.